Morning, Ralph. How are you?
Hey, Ralph.
Hey, doing great. How are you guys?
Oh, my goodness. If we were any better, we'd have to be twins, and this interview lasts twice as long. Ralph, we've got some things to get out of the way with you, first of all. I'd like to describe our little setting here. Can you tell him where we sit at the round table here in Branson?
Well, we're at the round table in Branson, and we have a bunch of folks that join us every morning, and they can go to klfcradio.com and listen to us around the world. So that's where we're at from 7 to 8:30 weekdays.
And we get a lot of books. We don't read the books. We don't have time to do that. Keith doesn't because he owns a copy shop. I would have time, but I can't read very well. But we love talking to our authors about the books. So, and my co-host, which is so good for me, my co-host is blind. So I like to help him in the very beginning. So bear with me. So first of all, Keith, here's the book.
Okay. Ooh, nice size book.
Huh? Nice, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
And see, now as a printer, I look at that and I say, oh, that's a perfect bound book. It's not spiral bound. It's perfect bound book.
You've been a printer for 8 months.
Well, no, I've been a printer for a year.
Wow, and you know that stuff.
Yeah, here, I don't print. So here we go. Sighted people do.
Ancient Wisdom.
Ooh.
For the Good Life by Ralph K. Hawkins. But listen to this.
That.
I love this on the back here.
All right.
For millennia, people everywhere have been searching for the good life. Boy, isn't that the truth?
Yes, they have.
As far back as ancient Greece, philosophers believed that possessing virtue led to it. But in Western society today, here we go, Keith, many people think the way to the good life is to be doing whatever they
want.
This kind of thinking, however, has led only to the decline of the family and community, along with a myriad of personal and social problems. Our guest this morning, Mr. Ralph Hawkins.
Boy, Ralph, that's great information that we want to open up. But first of all, we'd like to find out a little bit about you, where you're born and grew up, and then how this book came about.
Well, thank you for having me, Charlie and Keith. It's great to be with you guys this morning. I was born in Yuma, Arizona, on the Marine base there, but my parents moved to Alabama when I was about two, so I grew up in Alabama.
Hmm. Go Tide. I've got people in Alabama like crazy all over that state. What area of the state did you grow up in?
I grew up in Birmingham.
Okay. Yep. Vulcan. Then if I say Vulcan to you, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great place. They've remodeled it in the last couple of decades, and
really?
It's a beautiful place to go now. Yeah.
Wow. Let me interrupt.
My dad asked my mother to marry him at the foot of Vulcan. Oh. It's a big statue on a hill overlooking Birmingham.
That's tender, Keith.
Tender.
So let's make sure
tender
we get
spot.
Let's get Ralph's loyalty off the bat.
Yeah. Is it Auburn or
Oh, come
Alabama?
On. Why didn't it's UAB?
Oh, yeah, that's true, too.
Which one is it, Ralph?
Well, my grandfather was a diehard Roll Tide fan.
Oh, my gosh. he probably went to school with Bear Bryant.
Probably.
Well, in his retirement, he and my Nana followed Bear Bryant. They bought a camper and followed Bear Bryant all over the country.
Wow.
Well, I guess that answers that Roll
yeah,
Tide.
Yeah, it does, Roll Tide.
You got a new coach. We'll see how you do. So continue on this journey. Through high school.
So Birmingham, yep. What happens after that?
What happened after Birmingham?
Oh, well, high school there? Did you go to college? What'd you do?
Yeah, I grew up in Birmingham, and I went to the Alabama School of Fine Arts, and then I moved up to Nashville, went to college there, met my wife in Nashville, and got married, and then we started moving around. We moved all over the country. Yeah, I started out in the pastorate in East Tennessee, and then went down to North Alabama, and then up to Michigan, and then from there down to Eastern Kentucky, and then to Virginia.
Now, let's stay with some of these places.
He did.
Sounds to me like you went from the Holy Land to the wilderness when you went from all those southern.
Really?
How close to Knoxville in East Tennessee? No, I'm sorry. I went the wrong way. How close to Memphis?
That's west.
Way. You're right. You're right, Keith.
Yeah, Memphis is in the west.
Right. I meant Knoxville. I was right.
What city in Tennessee?
Yeah, we were about an hour west of Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. B's Restaurant in Chattanooga. We like that one. Now, what? Oh,
I don't know that one.
Oh, my. It's you sit down at a table with people you don't even know. and it's a big Lazy Susan in the middle, and they bring you a family style food.
Wow.
It's neat.
That sounds pretty nice.
That's pretty good.
So how did you get to the ministry, and how did God touch your life and get you saved?
Well, I went to David Lipscomb University, and I didn't plan to do it, but when I got there, it turned out my advisor was the professor of Hebrew, and he convinced me to start taking Hebrew my very first semester. I think he didn't have enough students or something, so he was desperate for students. I don't know, but he talked me into it, and I started taking Hebrew my first semester as a freshman, and I fell in love with it. And of course, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, so when I fell in love with Hebrew, I fell in love with the Bible, and literally that charted the direction that I'm still on now, decades later. I spent several years studying biblical languages and started pastoring in the middle of my senior year, started a student pastorate, and I've done a lot of other things over the years, but have always stayed in the pastorate and continue to be a student of the Bible throughout my working life. I eventually went on and did a PhD in biblical and Near Eastern archaeology. And so since about 2004, I've been teaching Old Testament on the college level, and I currently am the director of the Program of Religion at Averett University in South Central Virginia, where I teach Old Testament and other things as well, but I continue to work in the church as well. So I've kind of, throughout my working life, I've always had one foot in the world of the church and one foot in the world of academics.
Have you ever been on an archaeological dig?
I have. In fact, that's part of the reason I started my PhD. When I was early in my career as a pastor, I volunteered on an archaeological dig. And the reason I did it is because when I was working on my master's degree, I had had some classes in Old Testament that exposed me to some archaeology in the Holy Land. And so early in the pastorate, I volunteered on a dig and went to Israel and fell in love with that. And I went back every summer for 4 years, and my wife finally told me, she said, "You got to stop spending all this money or change careers." I sat on that a couple of years, and then we sold everything we had and moved to Michigan, and I started a PhD in biblical and Near Eastern archaeology. So my PhD really focuses on the archaeology of the Old Testament world.
Well, we love Israel, and we have contacts there. One of our contacts that we talk to all the time lives in the Golan Heights, and he's a biblical scholar also. The Bible Comes to Life, if you want to write that down and take a look at that. The Bible Comes to Life. He is a Jewish fellow that believes everything but the resurrection, but he's close, let me tell you.
Yeah, he is. So, we had a gentleman on the air the other day, Tim Mahoney, that did the film Patterns of Evidence, and I don't know if you've seen that, but it's great.
Yeah. I don't know Tim, but I've heard great things about
it. It's pretty neat. We're going to dive into ancient wisdom for just a minute, because you seem to have ancient wisdom. We want to dive into this for a minute. And just the other day, Keith, I'm doing a little study on Sundays at a senior center on obscure people in the Bible. People like Balaam. I don't call Mordecai obscure because we like that account so well,
right,
Keith.
Right.
The thief on the cross, I really don't call him obscure. Mm-hmm. But others. And one of the gentlemen I'm getting ready to do is Ehud. Okay, Keith? I won't even
Ehud?
Get yeah. I had to look that one up.
Yeah.
But somebody was doing archaeological dig like you're talking about, and it was either Ehud or one of these, and his name was on a piece of pottery. Boy, when you find stuff like that, doesn't it just make things come alive and go, wow, look at this? Your thought.
Well, it sure does. I love archaeology. When you go to the Holy Land and walk around these sites and the pottery's crunching under your feet, it's almost like getting in a time machine and going back to the biblical world. It really brings the Bible to life.
Ralph, what is the good life?
Well, The Good Life is something that people have been looking for a long time. It was a really popular topic for discussion among the great philosophers of the ancient world. People like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle were looking for it, and they wrote a lot about it. But what's interesting about their quest for the good life in the ancient world was that people like Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle basically thought that it was out of reach for the average person and that it could only be attained by an elite class of philosophers. But in the Old Testament, there's a group of books that we call the wisdom literature, and that includes five books: Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Ecclesiastes. And those books were written by ancient Israel's wise men, their sages, and those books taught that wisdom is for everyone, and that everyone could attain the good life through that wisdom.
You know, your book, Wisdom, Ancient Wisdom, well, Charlie and I are ancient, but wise. If you go back and you look, there was some pretty wise people way back, and God was in their lives and directed a lot of their lives. But tell me about the cover, between the covers of this book, walk through a few of the chapters that we need to be drawn to, and then we're going to talk about where this book is available.
And Keith, this is a good time for somebody listening who says, I like that book. That's my kind of deal. You call Krista today at
417-334-5532. And
one more time.
417-334-5532. You give her your name and phone number, and she'll work out when you can get this book.
And thanks to Don Otis and fine people at his organization, Veritas, and the author, of course, we can present you that book. Go ahead, Keith.
All right, so give me some of the chapters that we need to know about.
Well, one of the things that that I talk about in the book is how anybody can grasp God's wisdom, whereas the ancient philosophers said that it was out of reach. The wisdom literature in the Bible teaches that it's for everybody. I think, for example, of Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom is portrayed as a woman. Biblical scholars often refer to her as Lady Wisdom, so it's just kind of a caricature of wisdom. But she's standing out at the crossroads, and she's calling out to everybody that walks by, and she's saying, "Oh, people, I call out to you, and my cry is for all who live. Oh, simple ones, come into me and learn prudence. Acquire intelligence, all you who lack it." So she's standing out there and calling out to everybody who passes by with a promise that anybody can grasp God's wisdom, understand it, and receive its benefits. And so it's really a universal call to the good life. And she's offering instruction and wisdom. So in ancient Israel, wisdom was not viewed like the philosophers viewed it, as something obscure, but it was viewed as skill for living. So ancient biblical wisdom is literally skill for living. It's about the ways of things, how things are meant to exist and work and function properly. And biblical wisdom deals with all kinds of activities, everything from sowing to farming to building and to communicating and so on. And so in the book, I've got chapters that look at what the wisdom writers had to say about all these different things. I've got chapters on time, chapters on work, chapters on sex and marriage, chapters just on almost anything you can think of. It's talked about in the book and what ancient Israel sages had to say about it.
Well, that's pretty encompassing. Is this meant as a devotional, or is it meant as a read from cover to cover?
Well, the first chapter introduces the wisdom literature. So if somebody is not familiar with it, they could start with that first chapter, and it just introduces them to the books of Job and Psalms. So not all the Psalms are part of the wisdom literature, but there are a lot of different kinds of Psalms. But some of the Psalms are what we call wisdom Psalms. And then there's an introduction to Proverbs and Song of Songs and Ecclesiastes. So that first chapter is just a crash course, just introducing readers to to the wisdom literature. The second chapter then goes into what is the foundation for understanding the quest for the good life. And according to Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so the second chapter talks about what that means. What is the fear of the Lord? How is it the beginning of wisdom? Why is it important? And then chapter 3.
Time out. I want to interrupt you a minute. I want to go back to that. I want to go back to that for just a minute. Somebody listening today, maybe scanning across the dial, and they hear this word, the fear of the Lord. Would you dive into that for just a minute, Keith? Are you scared of him, Keith?
No, not scared, but a healthy respect.
Well, wait a minute. What's that mean then?
Yeah, what does it mean?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a really important chapter because in today's culture, the idea of fear is usually viewed negatively. We think of fear as, you know, the basic human instinct to run away or to defend yourself or to retaliate. And fear is a good translation of the Hebrew word, but the way we think of it in American culture, it's got all these negative connotations, and those don't really capture the sense, I don't think, of what the biblical writers were trying to convey. If you flip through some modern translations of the Bible, you'll see that some of these contemporary versions have tried to come up with alternate ways of translating the Hebrew word, like the New Century Version. Instead of translating fear of the Lord, it'll say respect for the Lord. The Good News translations will say reverence for the Lord. I suggest translating it as reverential awe. So I would translate it with two words, reverential awe, because I think that expresses more the positive sense of what the response to the Lord is that's being looked for. So the reverential awe for the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. When we revere the Lord and have awe for the Lord, then we will be able to embark on the wisdom quest. And ancient Israel sages taught that the reverential awe of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Again, Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, if we have reverential awe of the Lord, we will want to embrace wisdom. We will want to live according to God's ways. And this idea is really baked into the wisdom literature as a whole. That expression, fear of the Lord, which I'm translating reverential awe of the Lord, that appears at the beginning of the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. It appears in the middle of the book, and it brings the book to a conclusion in Proverbs 31:30. And then, so it appears at the beginning, the middle, and the end, and then it's scattered throughout the book 13 times. And it also appears in Job and Ecclesiastes and several of the wisdom psalms. So this idea that the reverential awe of the Lord provides the motivation for embarking on the study of wisdom is so foundational. You know, it's the foundation for wisdom. It's the starting point for wisdom. It just undergirds it in every way.
You know, at the end of the day, what do you want us to take away from it? Can we learn to be wise?
Yes, definitely. We can learn to be wise. One of the things I really want readers to discover in this book is just how relevant the wisdom literature is to life today. It literally speaks to every aspect of the modern life. And if you just think about what each book of the wisdom literature is trying to do, you see how comprehensive it is. For example, Job reflects on the moral structure of life. The Psalms address our relationship with God. Proverbs deals with society and family. The Song of Songs deals with love and sex. And Ecclesiastes examines the meaning of life. So the five books of the wisdom literature complement one another. They interlock to cover the whole field of wisdom. And really the overall purpose of wisdom literature as a whole is to help us develop a unified worldview with God at the center. So again, they cover everything. moral structure, relationship with God, society and family, love and sex, meaning of life. So you see how all those interlock to cover every subject in life, every field of wisdom. And so if we study the wisdom literature, it'll help us develop a unified worldview with God at the center. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and then each of the wisdom books addresses all those areas of our lives. So we can bring order to the chaos of our lives and our world by developing that kind of an integrated worldview that comes through the study of the wisdom literature.
Well, we're a big believer in biblical worldview. Ralph K. Hawkins is our guest. The title of the book is Ancient Wisdom for the Good Life, and this is the last opportunity you'll have to get it, 417-334-5532. Ralph, if you don't mind, we'd like to lean upon your career as a professor, archaeological dig type man, okay, Alabama fan. Can I ask you a couple of questions and let you help us this morning?
I'll do my best.
Now, we know that it's 5 to 9 where you're at, so you don't tell him. He doesn't get an attaboy.
No attaboy award for you today, Ralph.
We have authors from Oregon and California, and they get that attaboy. So I'm going to start with this one. I'm going to ask a question to my co-host, and he's going to answer me. He's going to answer me like he always answers me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, wait a minute, Ralph, what do you think of that answer? Are you ready, Keith?
Try me.
I am reading today from the English Standard Version. Keith?
Well, I talked the other day, Ralph, about...
Don't go right into what you told me immediately.
They talk about version of the Bible, the King James Version, the Standard Version, and I had heard a message one time at church that there's not versions of the Bible. There's one version of the Bible, and there's several translations.
Okay.
What do you think about that?
Well, let's see, there's only one version.
But there's several translations.
Don't back up on me, Ralph. I'm counting on you.
Come on, Ralph.
Well, that's true.
You can agree and be all right.
Yeah, I guess I would say that. Yeah, there are many translations. There's one.
Scripture. There's one Bible.
Yeah. I mean, there's one primary Hebrew text that goes back to the medieval period, and then before that we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which go back to essentially to the time of Jesus, and they show that from the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, from the time of Jesus all the way up to the medieval period, that those ancient Hebrew scriptures were copied by ancient scribes completely accurately, without mistake. The Bible was transmitted from one age to the next without error. And so it shows us that, there was the ancient Bible was uniform, it was consistent, it was correct. And what we have today in English are a multitude of translations rendering that one ancient Bible.
There you go. Hey,
Keith, come on.
You can just say I'm right.
Not going to say you're right, because my Bible says English Standard Version.
I know, but they put the wrong word there. It's like, and another thing, too, Ralph, is the stories of the Bible. You know, the story about Noah and the story about this and that. We were called on the carpet by Ken Ham over at the Creation Museum. Said, wait a minute, guys. A story can be fact or fiction, but an account is fact. And so we don't call them Bible stories anymore. We call them Bible accounts.
Okay. I don't know if I want to press that nuance too hard. I mean, you know, there are made up stories in the Bible. For example, you know, when Jesus tells parables are just, you know, little stories he made up.
I like that.
Yeah, they're just illustrations. So you know, I don't think we would press those. They don't. A story may be true. It may be just a made up illustration. You know, you go back to the book of Judges. One of the judges told a little story about talking trees to illustrate you know, to illustrate some truths of the kingdom. So, I mean, the story was true. It illustrated certain principles that were true, but it was a fictitious story.
The story, although it had a point, it wasn't true. The trees really didn't talk. But had talked, I would call it an account. But you can work that one out with Kim.
No. I'm with him. I'm with Ralph on this.
So you won one and lost
the next one. And the next time Ken comes on, I'm going to use that.
There you
go. Hey, stay with us. I got another one for you. And by the way, Keith and I like to take your class, and I'd like to make a better grade than him, and I don't want to sit next to him. Okay?
He'd copy off my paper, so.
Why would I copy off you?
Just because. Hey, we're going to continue Good Morning Ozark, so stay with us.
I can't wait to get the answer. I've been looking for the answer to this question for years.
Decades.
Today, I'm going to get it.
All right. And another thing, one thing that I want to mention is a lot of people, I think, and we'll talk about this after, confuse wisdom with knowledge. We'll talk about that in a moment on Good Morning Ozark. Stay with us. I want to tell you that if you missed the last half hour with our guest, you go to klfcradio.com and you'll be able to hear that. And we've been talking about Ancient Wisdom. That's the book. And it is gone now, but you can find it. And we'll find out where. So where is this book available?
You can find it on Amazon.com or on the publisher's website, which is HendricksonRose.com.
Okay. You know, a lot of people, I think, confuse maybe knowledge with wisdom, but I heard an explanation that really rings true in my mind, and maybe this is another one that between the versions and the accounts of the Bible and all that stuff, but you guys can both weigh on this if you want, that knowledge is knowing what to say, but wisdom is knowing when to say it. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that. There's an old saying, I don't know where this came from, but I've heard it all my life, to know and not to do is not to know. Yeah, I mean, we might claim to know something intellectually or cognitively, but if we don't implement it, if we don't do it, then we must not really know it, you know, because true knowing, you know, it goes from our head to our hands, you know, it works, it leads to action. And this is what the wisdom literature is all about. Biblical wisdom is about skill for living. It's about learning how to do things. Biblical wisdom is about the ways of things, how they're meant to exist and work and function properly. So biblical wisdom is designed to teach us how to do things more effectively, but also how to find their meaning in the whole of God's created order. So the wisdom literature is really trying to teach us how to do things in a way that's in harmony with God's order for the world. And we've already talked about how each of the wisdom books addresses different aspects of God's world so that all together the wisdom literature is comprehensive in nature. So, you know, if we claim to have knowledge, but we don't live in the ways outlined in the wisdom literature, well, then we haven't really grasped the knowledge if it hasn't led to action.
Very good.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Keith.
Yeah, I thought that's what.
Now, I want to go back to the fear of God and awe for just a minute, standing in the awe. Now, I've written a couple of things down, Keith, and I'll let you expand on that for me because you're so good at making me feel that I've done something right. Okay. All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm going to list a couple of maybe three things. And the first of all, standing in awe of something, mm-hmm. a volcano.
Right. While it's erupting.
Yes. When you see that video or whatever, Keith, wow. What do you say?
Yeah, you say, ooh, wow. I had the occasion to have people awe. I never saw the Grand Canyon when I could see, but I went there as a blind person, and I stood there and listened to people that saw it for the first time, and it was awe. I mean, it was awe-inspiring. It was huger than they thought.
Perfect. Number two, the launch of a rocket at NASA in Cape Canaveral.
I imagine if you were there live, it would be awe. Jaw-dropping, they say. Yeah.
How about at Yellowstone in the springs when the geysers go off?
Oh, yeah. When Old Faithful goes off, that's an awe moment.
So question for you, Professor Ralph. Are those all things?
Well, I mean, they sure. Of course, we use like those words, revere and awe. I mean, we use them for a lot of other things. We might say we're in awe of Michael Jordan's basketball skill, sure, or something like that. So it doesn't lead us to worship him. Or if it does, then we're sadly misguided.
Right.
But, I don't know. This may not be a perfect translation, reverential awe. Fear of the Lord or reverential awe for the Lord. If it's going to be the beginning of wisdom, the idea is that it would lead us to worship the Lord. I think, when you think about how that works, the ancient Israelite sages, they talked about the fear of the Lord, and they believed there was a really close relationship between the fear of the Lord and love and reverence for God's law. So they believed that if people had a proper reverential awe for the Lord or proper fear of the Lord, that would compel them to obey the Lord or want to follow his law. For example, in one of the wisdom psalms, this is Psalm 34, verses 11 through 22, but the psalmist invites children to come to him so that he can teach them the fear of the Lord, and then he proceeds to teach them about the importance of God's law. So there's this idea that if you have the proper foundation of fear of the Lord or reverential awe of the Lord, then it will compel, you'll feel compelled to follow God's law. You'll be interested in God's law. You'll want to follow it. And another example is the book of Ecclesiastes. In the book of Ecclesiastes, the author has, he goes through all the ways that he's been on the quest for the good life. And he's done great construction projects. He's launched businesses. He's had all kinds of sexual partners. He's spent his whole life looking for fulfillment and for the good life. And what he's found is that all of it was vanity.
Right.
His quest came up empty. But then at the end of the book in Ecclesiastes 12:13, he says, what I've found out is that when you shuck it all back to the cob, that's an old Alabama
expression. We know exactly what it is.
Yeah, I spent time in Nebraska, so I know what that is.
Yeah, he says, when you shuck it back to the cob, this is my own translation. But he says, when you shuck it back to the cob, the whole duty of man is to fear God. So there's that fear of the Lord. It's to fear God and keep his commandments. So a proper reverential awe of God leads to a desire to keep God's commandments. It leads to the realization that the good life is found through cultivating the kind of life built on the foundation of God's teachings. And this is really, again, this idea that the fear of God leads to a desire to follow his ways. That's a main emphasis in the first five books of the Old Testament, which are called the Pentateuch or the Torah. It's this idea that love and reverential awe of the Lord leads one to follow his ways. I think of Deuteronomy chapter 10. This is a great passage where Deuteronomy 10, 12 through 13, where God, Moses rather, he says, "Now, O Israel, what is it the Lord really wants from you?" He's trying to shuck it all back to the cob. And he says, here it is. Only to fear the Lord your God, so there's that reverential awe of the Lord, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So there you see it again, a proper love and a proper reverential awe of the Lord leads to the desire and the ability and the motivation to follow his ways. If people recapture their sense of the reverential awe for the Lord, it leads them to follow his ways, and it leads to a revolution in life.
Well, I'm going to do something here this morning. I'm going to change horses. I'm going to talk about shucking to the cob in just a minute, Keith. I sat there in our old granary, and my dad had me shucking the corn to the cob by hand.
Oh, boy.
And he'd start it, but then Dad showed me an old-fashioned something. You know what it was, Keith?
No.
It was an old-fashioned hand corn sheller.
Hmm.
You'd put that ear of corn in there, and it'd shell it without having to take your thumbs.
Really?
That was a great gadget.
I imagine it was.
And then somebody put a motor on that baby and even made it faster.
Man.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break, do the verse of the day. Keith told me we could do this. This is the first time we've done it like this, because every day, Professor Ralph, we do the break and the verse of the day, Keith.
Yep.
And I said, well, what about when we have a guest? And you said,
hey, you can do it right there. You tell the guest and you do the verse of the day and you come right back and continue.
Well, wait a minute.
We do that all the time.
I can't change my phone yet. I got to ask him this question. He can answer it on the other side of the verse.
Okay.
All right. Write this down for me, Doc. Are you ready?
All right. I'm ready.
All right. I've read this years and years and years, and I don't know the answer. It comes from Kings, and it says, Ward and how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. When we come back, I want to know, what is the book of Chronicles of the King of Israel? We'll be right back. Ralph Hawkins, our guest this morning for The Good Life, and the book is given away. In fact, somebody else tried to get it, and it was gone, so thank you all so much. So tell me, what are these Chronicles? I've read that so many times and never did get the answer. What are they?
Well, in the Old Testament, the writers of the Old Testament, you know, that we often think of the Old Testament as if it just dropped down out of the sky as a finished product, but it was actually written, you know, by human authors who utilized various sources. So, when you're reading in the books of Kings, for example, the writers will say, okay, I'm telling this story about this king who did thus and such. If you want to know more about that king, go check out the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And every ancient king in the ancient world had scribes who would keep records about what that king did in his administration as a king, and they would have a royal library, and they would have tablets in that library that would contain chronicles, just records about what the king had done. And ancient Israel was no different. So the writer who's telling the story in Kings, he'll say, well, I'm telling you about King Jehu or King whoever, if you want to know more about what they did in this, making this treaty with these people, or doing this particular construction project or whatever, go check out the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. In other passages, when he's talking about the southern kings, the kings of Judah, he'll say the same thing there. He'll say, you can read more about this in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. And there are other records mentioned in the Old Testament as well. For example, in one of them is the book of Jashar. that is a source that's only mentioned, I think, twice, two or three times in the Old Testament. One of the famous references to the book of Jashar is in Joshua 10:13, where the author of Joshua is telling about the famous day the sun stood still.
Mm-hmm.
And he just tells a little bit about it, and then he says, you know, haven't... if you want to know more about this, you can consult the book of Jashar. And that's, the author says that in Joshua 10:13. So these are just sources outside the Bible that the authors of the Old Testament books utilized as they wrote the Bible. And they tell readers that if they want to know more about what they're writing about, they can consult those sources. So it's kind of like when a student in college does a research paper, you know, they go to the library and they check out all these books, they spread them out on the table, and they consult these books as they write their paper. Well, the Old Testament authors were, you know, they were writing a history book as well, and they consulted various sources as they did that.
I love that.
So these references to the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel or the book of Joshua those are kind of like their footnotes.
I love it.
That's
good. I kind of felt that, but I wanted to have it. It's kind of like if it's first and 10 and the field announcer says it and Mr. Bear Bryant says it's a first down, I get it.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. So according to 1 Kings 2:4, the Dewey Decimal System was formed at that point. Is that right, Keith?
I sure.
Into the library.
Yeah.
Hey, this has been a lot of fun. We thank you for joining us today and really appreciate you joining us, our guest Ralph Hawkins, for The Good Life. Ancient Wisdom is the title of the book, Keith.
And you can get it at Amazon. And do you have a website of your own?
Well, I have a website for archaeology, but if people are interested in Ancient Wisdom for the Good Life, they can just find it on Amazon.com or HendricksonRose.com. And I'm on Facebook and put a lot of stuff about ancient wisdom and archaeology there. People are welcome to connect with me there if they would like.
And how do we find your Facebook page?
It's just under the name Ralph K. Hawkins.
Okay. Very good, Ralph. Thank you so much.
Do you mind, Keith? You're in class with me. I'm gonna prove to Ralph that I know something.
Oh, yeah, that you're wise?
No, I didn't say that.
But I just have knowledge.
Now, I'm going to ask him to repeat it. And then after he repeats it, here's the deal. If you can answer the question before I give it to you. Okay, Keith.
How could I do that?
Because you're going to hear what he says, and you're going to say, oh, I know that. Ralph. Give me the name of the publisher again, please.
Oh, the publisher.
It's Hendrickson Publishing.
And add the other name to it. Add the other name
Rose.
To it.
Yeah.
Okay, Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, their website is HendricksonRose.com.
Okay, Keith, go ahead.
I thought Rose Publishing, did they have a cousin that was Hendrickson? So they got together or what?
Keith?
What?
What were some of our best books that we ever have done that are full of detail and graphics and maps and Rose Publishing?
Yes.
Guess what?
What?
They ain't Rose no more.
They're now Hendrickson.
Because there's a dressing like that, too. The reason that I know that is I went to call Rose the other day and went through an entire liturgy finding all this out, and I found out about Hendrickson Rose, and they had been bought by these and merged together.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's
and I'm
it.
Sure the reason they picked him up and liked what Ralph is doing because it goes right along with their line of thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good.
How'd I do there, Ralph? Was that do I get an A on that one
you
or
did
no?
Pretty good.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Look at that, Keith. Do
very
you think
good.
If we talk a lot in your class, is it different in college, or can you chew gum and talk out loud and stuff?
Charlie spent a lot of time in the hallway when he was in school, by the way.
You know, I love it when students talk in class. I wish they would do more of that.
Yeah,
but you don't want them to talk to each other.
Well, that,
that's a problem.
I love it when they ask questions and engage.
There you go.
That's what I'm talking about.
Did you engage? Or did
in
you
a heartbeat, I did.
Yeah.
Some of the teachers didn't think. Get your desk out in the hallway.
Yeah, really.
It's Good Morning Ozarks. Thanks for joining us. Tell our good friends over at Veritas and Don Otis, another great author. Thank you very much, buddy.
See you later.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much, Carl and Keith.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.